Coming up on this episode of the Mario Rosenstock podcast.
So he was extraordinary in elevating the status of coaches when he became really famous in the 50s. He said, I'm the guy that is going to get results here, so the buck stops with me. I should be paid accordingly. And he was absolutely fearless. He grew up on the streets. He used to headbutt people if he didn't agree with them. He was a tough, tough man. And he also had amazing charm and powers of persuasion. He's a titanic figure.
This is a conversation I really enjoyed. I'm a huge football fan, going back to when I can first remember being interested in any sport at all. I loved football as a kid, played a lot of it as a kid. And full disclosure, I'm a Liverpool fan since I was 5. I don't go on about football that much. Obviously, I do a lot of football characters on GIF Grub. I don't go on about football a lot because actually I'm not a massive fan of modern football, would you believe? I just think it's becoming increasingly boring, the tippy-tappy kind of football that we go through nowadays as pioneered by kind of, I suppose, Man City in the last 10, 12 years or so. But historically, I'm a huge football fan. I'm a big Ireland football fan as well, although there's not been much to shout about until Troy Parrott recently. I'm obviously fascinated by the best players we've had the privilege of watching on telly mainly. The greatest player I've ever seen, and you'll hear me talk about it in this with Richard, is Maradona. But I'm also fascinated by the great managers, Alex Ferguson, Jose Mourinho, obviously the great Bill Shankly, Jack Charlton. So managers are a very interesting subject as well. And many of them have become popular characters for me on GIF Grub down through the years. And that's why I was delighted when I received a copy of a new book all about one of the most interesting and successful football managers of all time. And you've probably never heard of him. And I have to say, I didn't either, even though I actually know a fair bit about football. And I hadn't heard of him. And his name was Helenio Herrera, or HH. As he was known. And what a life he had. Born into abject poverty in Argentina, he went on to become a mediocre, medium-range football player, but incredibly accomplished, wealthy and famous football manager. The first, you could say, superstar football manager. He's credited with inventing modern football manager tactics and motivation and psychological preparation, etc. And he led an amazingly colourful life. Barcelona-based Irish football writer Richard Fitzpatrick has just published a fascinating profile of this man, and he joins me on this episode of the Mario Rosenstock podcast to tell me all about it.
That president at Inter was an oil tycoon. He had to pay Herrera's wife a salary on the sly in order to curry favour with HH. He would say, will you ask HH to play this friendly match? He was afraid to go to him head on, and this is one of the richest men in the world. And he asked him, what's the secret to your success? And he said, it's one very simple thing, get the players in your pocket and everything else is fine after that. You know, he's given a good squad, he will do brilliant things with them, and that's what Jose Mourinho did for the first two-thirds of his career. Like, I live in Barcelona, the atmosphere in the Camp Nou is awful. It's full of tourists. They have this dynamic pricing. The tickets are astronomical. You look back now and you see the authority that Alex Ferguson had at the club, that players just immediately stood taller when he was in the dressing room. And he set standards of excellence
himself,
at the club.
Himself. That's what he set them himself. He was first into the office every morning.
Yeah.
I think they knew that he was different level, you know?
My full chat, and it's a fascinating chat, with Richard Fitzpatrick, author of HH, Helenio Herrera, the original master of the dark arts, is coming right up. But as this episode is going to be all about great football management, we put a call into some of the great footballers and asked them to reveal which manager they most admire. Roy Keane.
My favourite manager. Obviously my favourite manager at the end of the day, the one I most admire. Well, I'd have to say Mick McCarthy at the end of the day.
Only joking, obviously, a credit to humour. No, it's Fergie. You know, as a man, I had no time for him at all. But as a manager, top class at the end of the day. No nonsense, never smiling, chewing gum, very few words, a lot of impact. All he's missing is the beard and the Cork accent.
Jose Mourinho.
My favourite manager. I think he's a total legend. Extremely talented, great with players. Physically beautiful, irresistible to women. Every man wants to be him. I think you know who I'm talking about. Very nice.
Eamon Dunphy.
I think Sam Allardyce is a great manager. He's a job's worth. He's a journeyman like myself, but he's capable of coming in and doing any job, especially at the end of the season. He comes in, he fills in, and he does the role, and you know, he takes what's in front of him. I think I hear he's in the job, in the running for the new Ayatollah, the interim Ayatollah in Iran. I think he's going to come in for the next couple of months to see. Well, I think he'd do a great job as the Ayatollah Allardyce.
And Ayatollah Allardyce is a role I'd love to see Big Sam performing. Okay, it's time to meet my special guest on this episode. His new book is a profile of one of football's most successful, colourful and controversial characters. The original celebrity manager, you could say, Helenio Herrera, also known as HH. Barcelona-based Irish football writer Richard Fitzpatrick is the man behind the book. So let's jump straight in.
First of all, thanks a million for doing this. I was a big fan of the Eamon Dunphy podcast, The Stand.
Oh, yeah. Eamon did my launch. Yeah, Eamon's
and,
great.
And you appeared 3 to 4 times on Eamon's podcast, and I remember listening to them all. You were on about Spain, you were on about football culture in Spain, and you did some stuff about UEFA as well. And Eamon launched your book, did he?
Wheelhouse.
Oh, that's
he
lovely.
He did, yeah, in Dublin.
He's a great supporter, isn't he?
Yeah. He's brilliant. He's
and he would have said all the right things, Richard. This guy, this is one of the great guys. This isn't a spoofer. I'm used to talking to spoofers, you know, but this guy, he knows, this guy's not a fucking idiot, you know. This guy knows what he's doing. He's a great guy, Richard Fitzpatrick. And you know, he knows nearly as much of football as I do. And, I didn't even know that Ufarte was the guy that scored the goal against us, against me, when I was playing. I was on the pitch with John Giles. I didn't know. And Richard had to remind me that it was Ufarte. And I said, I never fart. And he said, Ufarte. And I said, I didn't fart. I never fart. Dan is only reminding that it was a great Spanish player that I was talking about. But anyway, so that's just to break the ice, Richard. But you moved to Spain and you moved to Barcelona in 2010, yeah?
Exactly, usual story. I met a girl chasing after her. She is Venezuelan and she was moving there to.
Well, now, if there's any kind of girls you want to be chasing after, it's the Venezuelans.
They're per capita, they're top of the table of this world.
They've never been relegated.
No. They're Premier Division status locked in.
And so you chased her and you went out to Barcelona.
Exactly. Yeah, I'd been living in Dublin. I was in Dublin for.
But you
about
don't
10
have
years,
a good. You don't have a Dublin accent.
No, I'm from Clare, from the Banner County. Yeah, and so I moved out to Barcelona then and. Have stayed since, two kids and a dog. No, there's
fantastic.
No going back.
And of course, you know, not that I have to tell you, but just maybe my listeners who aren't familiar, but the Barcelona would be, you know, in Catalonia and Spain and the main body of Spain are very different places, as El País Vasco and the Basque area. And, you know, politically, it's massively different, isn't it? They see themselves as independent.
The People's Republic of Catalonia. Irish people would empathise with their situation. That was my case when I moved there. I could see huge similarities with their relationship with the British Empire or what have you. But it's important to make clear that it's not 80% in favour of independence or secession. It's typically about. It wavers from 30 to 45% in support of seceding from Spain. So most people are down the middle. You know, they can hold a dual identity, but we hear most noise from the extremes, from the separatists or the very pro-Spanish element, at which there is a lot in Barcelona, funnily. Like there's about 1 million Real Madrid supporters in Greater Barcelona, far more than Espanyol, the other big football team here. So it's complicated.
It is. So I know nothing about this. So would the main reason that Catalonians be supportive of staying within the body of Spain, would that be an economic reason?
I would say to be more emotional and demographical. There's huge, over the centuries, particularly in the 60s, there's mass migration from other parts of Spain into Catalonia for economic reasons. Catalonia is one of the engines of the Spanish economy. It would be the Basque country, Catalonia. Catalonia is three or four times the size of the Basque country and the Madrid region. So Catalonia has always been prosperous. People have moved here. Their grandkids now have this very kind of mixed or dual identity. They are more Spain than Catalan, but it'd be more for those kind of emotional reasons why they would identify with Spain rather than economic. It actually goes the other way. People in Catalonia, the separatists, they harp on, oh, we're subsidizing the rest of the country. And it's quite, it's nasty for me, being an outsider. Like they're, you know, a portion of them look down, you know, oh, the lazy Southerners, those people down in Andalusia, you know, we're subsidizing them. So it's.
Do you speak Catalan?
I don't. And it's interesting. That was the most noticeable thing that I when I came here, it was this Catalan language, which is closer to French than it is to Spanish, how widespread it is in the streets here all the time. And we have two kids and they go to school. All the schooling is done through Catalan. So they speak Catalan with all their friends at home. Then they'd speak Spanish. Their mom is a Spanish speaker, but the Catalan is very pronounced here, and they were very clever, the Catalans, when the democracy came in the late 70s. Catalonia is one of 17 regions, and they have autonomous powers, and one of the things that they enshrined was that the schooling would be done in Catalan. So you can imagine how endemic then, or how widespread the Catalan language has become as a result. It was a very, very clever move. So it's like, we know, your listeners would know, the Irish, how we struggled over the last 150 years to sustain the language. But here it's people speak it with pride. Like it's a real badge of identity, and it was banned for centuries, especially during the Franco.
Does it sound French just for a person who doesn't speak it, or?
It kind of has, it's this slurping sound. It's the Madrileños, or people in other parts of Spain, call Catalans Polacos, Polish people, because they think it sounds like Polish. So it's a curious mix. Yeah, it's got French vocabulary, but it's a very thick kind of accent.
Yeah, I taught English in Spain for 3 months in the Basque region. When I was a kid,
Right.
And, you know, it was a Geruarte and Agur, Agur. the fiestas and everything and Tafaya and the Toros.
Yeah.
I was flicking through the book and it's very comprehensive. And I read briefly the author's note there. And my heart lit up when, of course, you said that you love Maradona. And Maradona is, you know, by head and shoulders, my favorite footballer, the greatest footballer I've ever seen. I refuse to believe there's ever been a better footballer. I cannot accept that there has ever been a footballer, because we have enough of him on film. We don't have enough of Pelé on film to know. And I've looked for everything on Pelé I can, and it's not enough of him and to judge. But Maradona, there is enough, and there's enough to judge, in my view. That he is the greatest player. I've seen, you know, not to keep the argument, we'll talk about other things and Patrick can edit as he wishes, but, you know, I obviously could see Messi and some of the goals he scored. But for me, Messi is an amazing player and one of the greatest players of all time, but primarily amazing for doing, if you like, the same thing over and over again, dribbling an unbelievable dribbler. So he is a mesmeric dribbler with a low center of gravity. He's able to get by. He's got 5 or 10 meters of pace, which enables him to get by this place. But Maradona had everything. Maradona had everything. Mm-hmm. Maradona was like a human seal.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think if you just trust your eyes, if you look at the footage of Maradona, what he could do with a ball, and he was playing on potato patches and getting hacked. You know, he used to wear shin pads at the back of his legs because he was getting hacked down so much. He was just extraordinary. There's a great clip online of Gary Lineker on, when he was playing for the rest of the world, as it was, because he was playing Barca at the time, against England for the centenary of the FA. And Maradona, everybody wanted to see Maradona, including the players, like, and they watched him coming out of the tunnel, and he started juggling the ball and kicking it 12, 13 times up into the air, like 20, 30 feet into the air, and coming, it didn't move within like a 3 meter radius. And Lineker went back to Barca a day later, and they tried it, his teammates training, and the best anybody got was 3 times, and they were running across the pitch to get the third kick. Like, he just was amazing, his touch. Like,
I'm sure you've seen the little clip online. It was probably put up by a fan of Maradona warming up for Napoli, and it's "Life is life, la 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 la." And so in the stadium they're playing "Life is life, la 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 la, la 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 life," right? And on the camera, basically, it's before the match, and the camera is focused on Diego Armando Maradona warming up. His socks are around his ankles, and he's doing his stretches, and he's playing with the ball. And the stuff he is doing with the ball, without knowing anybody's even looking at him, is breathtaking. Just in his warm up.
Yeah. And I know it's off the charts, and also his personality, like in comparison to Messi. I've obviously lived in Barcelona for 15 or 16 years. I've covered Messi a lot. I've gone to Rosario to do stories on him, and he's a cold fish. In the modern parlance, I would say he's on a spectrum. He's just so tunnel vision, and that's what makes him great, because year in, year out, he just delivered. But he is a cold character, and he wasn't a good teammate for the junior players on his team. Like, wasn't an arm around shoulder guy, wasn't a great motivator for those guys at Barca. But Maradona, if you talk to his ex-teammates, they just adored him. He was always taking one for the team. Like, he'd do things to lift them up as well. They just would do anything for him. And also, if you think about where Maradona came from, it's very unusual with these South American players, the Brazilians and the Argentinians. They come from poverty, they're working class, but they're not from the shanty towns, because those kids just won't get the nutrition, or they just come from dreadful circumstances. They don't rise to the top. But Maradona and Carlos Tevez were two just exceptions, that they came from abject poverty. And to think, Maradona, you could say what you like about his personality. My wife is Venezuelan. She despised him because he ponied up to Chavez Castro and that. But he obviously was a Jack the Lad, like, but he's very intelligent, charming guy. Yeah. And to come from where he started, it's just incredible.
He tells a fascinating story. There's a fascinating story, and I think my listeners would be fascinated by this story as well, because it goes beyond football. And everybody's heard of the hand of God, the goal that Maradona scored against England in 1986. The second goal being the goal of God, but the first goal being the hand of God, and of course the way he cheated. And Lineker did the documentary where he follows Maradona down, and he goes in search of Diego Maradona to ask him, among other things, why did you do it? And it's fascinating, because he starts talking to Maradona. Maradona's lovely, and he loves Lineker, and he's so friendly. And you're right, he's really intelligent, thoughtful person, and totally uneducated, but very intelligent. And Maradona, and Lineker, with his Anglo-Saxon sense of English justice.
How is that justice?
Anglo-Saxon thing. You know, with indignation and the way they play by the rules, and they set down the rules. Or they're supposed to, he says, "So why did you do it?" And they translate it, and Maradona went, why did I do it? Because I could. And I said, yeah, but did you realize it was wrong? And Maradona is confused. He looks at Lineker and he goes, I don't think you understand the meaning of right and wrong. And Lineker goes, what do you mean? And Maradona says, what I did was seen as an act of nobility in Argentina. And Lineker, of course, aghast. What do you mean? And he went, in Argentina, for the pobrecito, the impoverished, to steal from cleverly from thing is regarded as an act of heroism. And Lineker didn't understand that. He didn't understand how the small man can rob from the big man, but if the small man gets away with it, it's regarded as noble. Yep. And this is a cultural thing in South America. It's culturally different. It's hemispherically different, right? And it reminded me of Bertie Ahern. The idea, like, well, I got away with it, lads. You know what I mean? And that's what it's all about, getting away with it. And of course, briefly, an addendum to that, Luis Suarez was another interesting, because when Luis Suarez came to the Northern Hemisphere, he got into trouble a lot for things like biting people's ears, but also use of the N-word in English. Which, exactly. So, Suarez was a little bit confused, because in Uruguay, use of the N-word is regarded as a term of affection. As far as I understand, there is a different interface with racism culturally in South America.
Correct. Yeah, I'm fascinated with that incident and racism. I've reported a lot on racism in football, because it comes up a lot in Spain, as you know, with Vinicius just last week. I remember asking a friend of my wife's who's Venezuelan about that incident, and she's black. And yeah, absolutely. In South America, it's a term of endearment, el negro. The black guy, or El Gordo. I've a friend of Michelle's, his wife is called La Gorda, the fat one. Yeah, and it's a woman, and she's called La Gorda, which I was always hesitant in saying, calling her.
I think the national lottery in Spain used to be christened El Gordo as well.
That's right. Correct. But the distinction that friend of mine made to me in the case of the, I explained what happened with Patrice Evra and Luis Suarez, and she said, this is a black woman, black Venezuelan woman. She said, the thing there is that he is white, effectively, Luis Suarez in Latino culture. That is not cool for him to do that. If it's a black person, because there is an element of threat to it, and aggression. So that would be the distinction of what she made. So I found that informative.
Very interesting.
In that particular instance.
Very interesting. Yeah. Okay, well, Richard, I'm loving this conversation, but we're going to spend the next 20 minutes talking about your book, which looks absolutely fascinating. And again, should be really interesting for people who are not just interested in football, not just interested in sport, but interested in socio-cultural matters and the way football and certain football people are embedded in our culture and all of that sort of stuff. This book takes in the story of Helenio Herrera. So give us a potted biography of who he was before we go deeper.
Yeah, well, what an enigmatic character. So one of the things about him is that he's so mysterious. Like when he was around in the mid-20th century in his heyday, as you can imagine, it was a time when there wasn't a digital footprint, and post-war people reinvented themselves. So nobody knew, you know, most people didn't know where he was from. He was born in Buenos Aires in 1910. His widow, his last wife, she only discovered, she was with him for almost 30 years. She only discovered after he died that he was actually born in 1910, since he had moved post-war from France to Spain in the late 40s. He had pretended that he was born in 1916. So she had to get his headstone adjusted. She did it with a marker. He's buried on a cemetery in Venice, on an island cemetery there. So he, born in Buenos Aires in 1910, moves to Casablanca then around 1913, 1914, and grew up in Morocco during the interwar years, and then moves to France in the late 20s to become a professional footballer. He was like a semi-professional footballer. Professional football in France, there wasn't much money, and much like the League of Ireland today, he double-jobbed. You know, he did all kinds of jobs on the side. Was a journeyman footballer, and then got into coaching at the end of the Second World War. Did well for a couple of years in France, was picked up then and moved to Spain, and landed a big job at Atletico Madrid in the late 40s, and immediately won back-to-back titles with them. Went on then and managed Barca at the end of the 90s. And he instigated the kind of cult of manager, cult of personality around the manager at Barca, which obviously went on in later decades with Cruyff, Cruyff's dream team, and Pep Guardiola. And so that, like, a club like Real Madrid doesn't have that cult of personality around the coach.
So then maybe to summarize what we're talking about here, we're talking about one of, because see, I told you I didn't know who he was, right? And so when you talk about great football figures of the 20th century, right? So obviously I would say things like, Cruyff, Beckenbauer, Alf Ramsey, Jock Steen, Bobby Charlton, Shankly, Busby. And then abroad, maybe, Mario Zagallo in Brazil, and Garrincha, and Pele, and Rivellino, and Puskas in Hungary, and some of these guys from the Austrian team and Italian teams of the 30s, and all of those kind of guys. But I didn't know about Helenio Herrera. But really, it turns out that this guy became the first superstar manager of all time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Like when he was operating, so he moved from Barca in the late 50s to Inter, and then that was his golden period, La Grande Inter, the great Inter team of the 60s. They were the team to beat in the 60s. He was a superstar coach. Some of those coaches you mentioned, like Jock Steen or say Matt Busby or Shanks, they were huge figures, contemporaries of his in Britain at the time. But those guys were subservient to their boards of directors and the chairman at the clubs, both in how they behaved and in financial terms. Those guys didn't make much money. They weren't well paid as coaches. This guy, HH, he was a huge figure. He was paid more than the franchise player at Barca, Kubala, who's an icon here. Is when he won at two statues outside the Camp Nou of Kubala and of Cruyff. And when he goes to Grand Inter then in the 60s, the president there was Angelo Moratti, and Italy at the time, in the 60s was the land of the lira. They were attracting all the best players from Britain.
Jimmy John Charles. Reeves,
Dennis Law. John Charles was the first great guy to go out there chasing the money. But HH, the money he was making, he made more than the coach and sporting director at Milan combined made, and that's excluding the huge bonuses he got. Just a small detail to illustrate how powerful he was. So that president at Inter was Angelo Moratti, an oil tycoon, a guy, one of the richest men in the world. His wealth was on a par with Aristotle Onassis at the time. And he had to pay Herrera's wife at the time a salary on the sly in order to curry favour with HH. He would say, will you ask HH to do this, play this friendly match? He was afraid to go to him head on, and it just one of the richest men in the world. There was Busby or Shanks cowered in front of their boards of directors. So he was extraordinary in elevating the status of coaches. He was the first guy to, when he became really famous in the 50s, he said, I'm the guy that is going to get results here. So the buck stops with me. I should be paid accordingly. And he was absolutely fearless. He was an unbelievable guy. Like, I would be fascinated with Alex Ferguson, and they talk about Ferguson's hairdryer treatment, but HH grew up on the streets. He used to headbutt people if he didn't agree with them. He was a tough, tough man. And he also had amazing charm and powers of persuasion. So he was extraordinary in that sense, in becoming so famous. He was even more famous than the most famous player of that era, which was Alfredo Di Stefano. So I know he's unknown to most football fans in Ireland and the British Isles, but in Spain, where I live, if you open up a newspaper every second day, he's mentioned. He's a titanic figure, and more so again.
Was he in a sense the first special one?
yeah, there's huge similarities with the way Jose Mourinho operates. Still, he would have taken a lot from the HH playbook. HH was a really bombastic character. He was outrageous in press conferences, goading people all the time. He was really like a hilarious. For me, doing the book, one of the kind of private stipulations I had with myself and with my own contract was that I knew I would have good company over the years it would take to research the book, because he was so funny. Like even back in the early 50s, he was managing Malaga at the time, and he started lambasting one of the rival clubs. I think it was Depor, saying that they had fixed a match, and this was like incredible behavior in a dictatorship, to be screaming about fixes being in, and like everybody kept their counsel. It was a police state. So people were shocked that he was doing this, but he didn't give a fig.
Did he have, did he mastermind tactics and motivational expertise? Was he a master of that area as well? And what kind of...
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, most people would know him in football as the godfather of Catenaccio. Yeah.
I'm the amateur here, so let me try it, right? My listeners, what I know is Catenaccio is the idea of... Catenaccio is the Italian idea of very, very defensively minded, and you suck the opposition into you. That you give them the ball, you let them have possession, and you draw them onto you so much until eventually you attack, and you attack quickly and counterattackingly, in one very, very quick movement to catch them unaware. And it's really, really embodied by, if you like, Italy's 1982 World Cup winning team, Bruno Conti and Tardelli and Paolo Rossi, you know, just coming from kind of nothing, and then they just strike and up the pitch they go, and then they get you.
Exactly. I'm really glad you pointed out the element of the transition, because people think of Catenaccio as this... very reactive system where you just flood the defense. The key element is you pull a midfielder out of midfield and you put him behind the defense as a sweeper. Beckenbauer would be the greatest exponent of it, and he can launch attacks from deep and he sweeps up the defense. But it was all about transition speed. Speed was a huge thing with HH. And Jock Steen, for example, went to Milan in 63. He was paid by a newspaper in Scotland to go over for a week and be mentored by HH. And he took away many things from that week there. HH was looking at him out of the corner of his eye, and he remarked about that big ant that was there in the sideline. But one of the things he took away about HH's breathing techniques, the control he had over the players' diets, particularly the control, the most important thing was the control he had over their social lives. But the transitions, Jock Steen said, was a revelation. Suddenly, eight players would just sweep forward, and they were like clockwork. It was prefiguring total football. He was the first guy to pull wingers back. Back into their own half, and then allow the wing backs or the full backs to flood forward, swapping positions. And he used to typically at a centre forward. He won seven league titles in Spain and Italy, and he never had an outright golden ball winner, a top scorer. He never had great centre forwards. He liked his centre forwards to lock the central defenders in position or pull them out of position so they could create so the centre forward could create space. And then he had the key element was he had a playmaker in the middle, and that was Luisito Suarez, who he brought from Barca to that Inter team. And he just peppered arrows around the around the pitch. He was the playmaker that pulled the strings. So it was all about creating space. And so, yeah, he was renowned as being the great innovator.
It's so funny that you say that now, because just while you were talking there, I was thinking back to Mourinho there for a minute, because we talked about, I just mentioned in passing that Mourinho was, you know, maybe Herrera was the first special one. And then it dawned on me while you were talking there that Mourinho, of course, started the main body of his professional life in Barcelona as the translator. Mourinho, of course, is brilliant with languages. He's multilingual, highly intelligent. Exactly, highly intelligent, able to conduct press conferences in 5 or 6 different languages.
With charm, like he's
with charm and nuance, and knowing maybe something of the interior of what he's talking about. In linguistically, and he was the translator for Robbie Robertson over in Barcelona. But also, what strikes me is that Mourinho then later went on to manage the European Cup winning Inter team.
The president of that Inter team was the son of Angelo Moratti. Yes.
Well, now you're talking, because now look at the game that he played. That Inter team wasn't fancied, but Mourinho played this highly disciplined, kind of Catenaccio style. It was a brick wall.
Yeah.
But then he broke at lightning pace. And they've secured the European Cup after that. And actually, that was one of the most amazing things of that was, because if you may have seen another YouTube clip, it's either called, or I call it, The Tears of Materazzi.
Outside
the car park. And I urge any of the listeners... Yeah. To watch this. And this is what Mourinho and maybe your man Herrera had with the players. This amazing, if you see the video, put in Tears of Materazzi, Jose Mourinho and Materazzi. And basically, I think it's the end of the European Cup, I think. Mourinho will be leaving the club, and he's just won the European Cup. He's going to go to Madrid, and he's in the car park. And this is just mobile phone footage. And you can see the players getting on the bus. But Mourinho is leaving in a car. But Mourinho sees the players getting on the bus. You see the car then putting on the brakes. He's obviously told the driver to stop. He gets out. It's like a movie. Staged. He gets out of the car and he's tearful. He's running towards a man. The man is Materazzi, the player on Inter Milan. Almost slow motion. They greet each other.
A door frame.
I know.
He's huge.
And they greet each other and they start hugging and hugging. And the hug lasts. Yeah. And they're both absolutely convulsed with tears. And then Mourinho just holds his head as if to say, you know, I'll see you again. And Morata is, don't leave me. And Mourinho goes, I've got to go. I am the special one. Goodbye now. I go to Real Madrid. I am doing my special business somewhere else. And off he goes. And it's like a movie.
But it was
completely not staged. It was genuine.
This
hold he had over his place. Was Herrera a bit like this?
Exactly. And when H.H. was interviewed, or not interviewed, he was in conversation with the president of Barca in the 60s, and he asked him, what's the secret to your success? And he said, it's one very simple thing, get the players in your pocket and everything else is fine after that. You know, he's given a good squad, he will do brilliant things with them. And that's what Jose Mourinho did for the first two-thirds of his career. They're both of them are incredible managers, and that's what the players almost universally loved. HH, I was surprised, or universally loved Mourinho, and similarly with HH, I was surprised by how gushing they were about HH, the players I interviewed. On the whole, one or two were upset with him, but they had been kind of discarded. Even though he was a tough guy, he'd brought them a lot of success, and he just had this amazing ability to cajole them. Like, he would drop players, he wouldn't talk to them, but the minute he needed them, it'd be arm around the shoulder and whispering into their ear, you're the greatest. Fabio Capello said, like, he would punch you in the stomach saying you're strong. And Capello had him at the start of his career, and he went on won Scudetti with Milan and Juventus afterwards. He said he never was as good a player as he had been with HH at Roma, because of that confidence he gave him. He was just an extraordinary motivator.
So one of the things that comes out of that is, and it's a modern expression now, especially in terms of sport, is emotional intelligence, EQ. People at the moment right now are talking about it in terms of rugby and Andy Farrell, and how Andy Farrell, the Irish coach, seems to demonstrate a high level of EQ, emotional intelligence, understanding his players, having a special relationship with his players, understanding being what it's like for them, and they then knowing what he knows about them. Like, for example, on Thursday, he brings in the parents before the match, and he brings in the parents to the dressing room, and there's a kind of a communal family thing going on, and it's demonstrating a lot of nous. Mourinho, it's clear, like, whatever you say about Mourinho, is that he must be at the absolute outer apex of intelligence in terms of managers. You know, I mean, and his emotional intelligence is very strong as well, understanding what kind of a person that player that he has is and what pushes their buttons.
Yeah, I think it's a kind of authority that the great managers have. Some of them, like, crack the whip, and HH operated at a time in the 50s and 60s, just coming out of the Second World War. You could be more aggressive, like, both physically and verbally. Like, one of his rivals, Heriberto Herrera, funnily enough, he was nicknamed HH2. He was the coach at Juventus in the 60s. One of his players, a midfielder, was involved in a traffic accident, and HH2 was goading him during training. He was there, "You're useless. You're only good for killing old people." Like, you could say those things back in the 60s. You wouldn't obviously say them now. But HH, you know, tough man, but he just had that ability to bring people with him. And I don't think it's like a club like Manchester United is quite hysterical at the moment. But you look back now and you see the authority that Alex Ferguson had at the club, that players just immediately stood taller when he was in the dressing room. He could carry them forward with him. And he set standards of excellence
himself,
at the club.
Himself. That's what he set them himself. He was first into the office every morning.
Yeah.
I think they knew that he was different level, you know.
Yeah, and you can see it in any code. Like, you talk about Andy Farrell, it strikes me as well, looking on from a distance at him, or in GAA down in Kilkenny, like Brian Cody, just immediately, like, people didn't...
There are some people you just don't want to let down, aren't there? There are just some people that you'll just break your bollocks just to try and make them happy.
Yeah, it's amazing. In any walk of life, we have friends or colleagues who have that impact on us, and those kind of people have that special aura.
You're right. It's in all walks of life, and not all of them are in areas of supreme authority. They just are. They have that thing that you'd never let them down. You don't want to let them down.
Yeah, they'll be the first you'll immediately respond to their text messages, or that, you know,
there's something about them, they have a dignity or they have standards or something. You know, like, for example, I remember Brian in the rugby situation, Brian O'Driscoll had standards, but that doesn't mean he's a leader, though. It's just that I don't think anybody would want to let him down, though, but it's just that he didn't personally graduate to leadership himself in that area, which is a different man of action, which nobody would want to leave down either. But it's amazing that Ferguson then would, you know, you're probably aware of that famous moment where Ferguson, they're playing Spurs, and they've come off a midweek Champions League game. They're tired. They're playing Tottenham Hotspur, and the players are remarked that Fergie hasn't come into the dressing room yet, and they're kind of going, "What's going on?" Like, he usually gives us a pep talk. Right, 5 minutes to three, Fergie opens the door and he just goes, "Lads, it's Spurs."
Yeah.
And he closes the door. In that moment, they know the message is clear. Lads, it's Spurs. You're meant to mow these guys over, and you fucking will. And there's nothing else to it. And then they all just went down and they just mowed them down. Because it's just Spurs. We're Manchester United. So in that moment, what he was saying was, "You are Manchester United and you are everything that we've worked for. You know it already. Just, I'm reminding you, they're Spurs."
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just incredible.
Yeah. I was Amazing, amazing. Like, I was taken in doing the research for this book with Shanks. I'm a Liverpool fan and I love Shankly. But he didn't, he never gave out fines to his players because he said he believed that you've lost them if you have to resort to fines. You know, he just had them by the power of his tongue.
But one of the things that came out of this is something, the elephant in the room, among which there are many elephants in the room. I could talk to you about another day, Richard. One elephant in the room, which I don't want to talk about now, but maybe I'll talk to you about it another way. I actually don't believe in this whole bubble of football at all. And I'll tell you briefly what I mean. Nowadays, I'm a Liverpool, massive Liverpool fan, and have been since those five, Steve Highway and all that sort of, back to Steve Highway and Ray Clements and all that. And then through the 80s and 90s and everything. And I remember watching football in the 90s and Cantona and all that and the matches. And it was hell for leather and ball was flying around and tackles were heavy and kind of, matches were well contested and gritty. Yeah. And nowadays matches are boring. It's tippy tippy tappy and matches are boring. Football is boring. And football is also outmoded in many respects because football matches last 90 minutes, 95 minutes, 100 minutes in a world where we only want things to last 5 minutes anymore. That's why darts has become very popular. High scoring, you know, we can see the scores, throw it in. Basketball will always stay there. Lots of scores, 89, 87. Right, right. Football, it's nil all after 100 minutes. And the modern person on the modern mobile phone with the dopamine needed all the time, it's not doing it anymore. And I think that there's a problem with I think there's a bubble going on. Now, I have no evidence to back this up. But you look at the billions and the billions and the billions, and the hundreds of billions and millions spent on the things. And I'm going, I don't see it. If you watch Liverpool versus Manchester United on Sky on Sunday in the league, there probably isn't any more than 3 million people watching that match on TV. Now, there used to be 20 million people watching it on Match of the Day at night in the 70s. Now, I just don't know where the money is coming from, and I think that there's a bubble. But maybe, and if you want to say something briefly about that, you can, because I wanted to ask you about something else.
I know where the money is going. It goes agents. Straight into the pockets of the players and the agents. Yeah. There's a couple of things I would say. Number one, football has never been more popular, like as in attendances at games and that. Obviously, the Premier League is the greatest show on earth. Now, it's like everybody follows it. It's huge in North America. It's really popular. The clubs, the big clubs are on a par with or just below the big franchises in the United States and North America. So they're not really overpriced. They have ballooned in value over the last 10 or 15 years. I know Atletico Madrid, for example, since Diego Simeone came in 2011, in that 15-year window, they've jumped 10 times their value. They're $2.5 billion they're worth now. They were only worth a quarter of $250 million when he came in. So I think there is the TV income is flatlining. It's probably
peaking.
For now it's gone it's saturated. It's not. There was huge jumps every 3 or 4 years, but now it's tapering off.
Is TV money the big money? Is that where they get no?
What? No, that's it's one of three blocks, but where they're all focusing and their future revenue growth is in the stadiums. That's why you've got Spurs, Barca is just completing a huge stadium overhaul. So the match day revenue, there is still room to make a sizable jump there. So that's what people are chasing. That's why United are.
But do you think that football is outpricing people?
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's terrible. Sure, the atmosphere. Like I live in Barcelona, the atmosphere in the Camp Nou is awful. It never was great, but now it's terrible because it's full of tourists. They have this dynamic pricing. The tickets are astronomical. The first game back in the revamped Camp Nou at 45,000 capacity, it will be 100,000 when it's finished. The prices were 200 to 600 euro, to get a ticket for the game, So it's kind of disappointing, you know, and the big beef I would have with football is just it's The competitiveness is gone. There's 8 or 12 super clubs. You see the same clubs in the last four of the Champions League or last eight. Like, nobody, I go to the games, but I'm not going to get excited about the Champions League until
Correct. And that's when you first see the first great games.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. So there's all these games, there's no jeopardy involved. The La Liga, as an example, has been cratered. It used to be a really competitive league. Athletic Bilbao won back-to-back titles in the 80s, so did Real Sociedad. You had Valencia in the early 2000s under Benitez. They won two league titles. Those guys will never win a La Liga title again. It's Barca, Madrid every season. The Premier League, yeah, is competitive. There's the big six or big five plus Spurs, but in the other leagues, it's Bayern Munich, Paris Saint-Germain.
Correct. Italy's they say that just because you're from Barcelona, but in Barcelona, but Barcelona Real Madrid is still one of the great El Clásicos, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Yeah. It's the biggest.
Is it? Is it really?
World,
do, would you?
Yeah. It, oh yeah. Oh, by numbers, yeah. When by eyeballs, when there's a Clásico, like there's hundreds of millions of people watching it. Yeah, because it, the best players in the world. Yeah. Like you have to go back to 2004. For a player who won the Ballon d'Or who wasn't a Barca or a Madrid player, except for Rodri 2 years ago. But even Dembélé was ex-Barca. You know, all the big players. Look at the players now that Madrid have. They've Mbappé, Vinicius, Bellingham is on a downward spiral. And then Barca have Pedri and Lamine Yamal. Like, Pedri is an incredible player.
And Lamine Yamal is still a teenager, is he?
He's still 18. Like
isn't it unbelievable? He seems to be in around forever.
How good he is.
And then the one I would love to go and see, and though, is apart excited. From Barcelona and thing.
Super Clásico.
Yeah, Boca, that's the one.
Oh,
that's the one. Boca and River is the one I'd love to go and see.
Yeah, proper atmosphere.
Bring your helmet and your gum shield.
It's a dream. yeah.
It must have been great when Maradona used to emerge over the balcony of Boca.
Oh. Can you imagine?
Remember and the fact that you're in Barcelona and you love Maradona, and of course Maradona spent a couple of great years in Barcelona. Mm-hmm. The highlight or the low light of which was the his butcher of Bilbao, Goycochea.
He keeps the boot that he used. Listeners,
if you want to know what we're talking about, just YouTube Maradona Barcelona and Goycochea. Goycochea is one of those G-O-I-E-X-C-H-E-A kind of names. But he was Antonio Goycochea or something was his name. And he was a defender. Anthony. And he was a ruthless centre-back. And his duty during this particular match was to just beat the shit out of Maradona. And Maradona isn't having any of it.
Yeah. There was a running feud. They supplanted Real Madrid as Barca's big rival at the time. They hated each other. It was a fierce rivalry. Athletic Bilbao were winning league titles at that time. They had a great team. And they had several pitch battles, if most infamously in at the end of the 83-84 season. It just turned into kung fu fighting. Like, it's amazing footage. But earlier, was it in the first Maradona's first or second season? I think it was early in his second season. Goycochea hacked him down and broke his ankle, and it was. Goycochea keeps that boot he was wearing for that game in a glass case in his sitting room as a trophy.
A trophy.
yeah.
My God, and I saw some lovely footage there recently of Maradona playing in Lansdowne Road as well. Argentina versus Ireland in 1979.
Yes, amazing footage. Amazing footage. Just waltzing around.
Yeah, but playing against some very good players as well. Irish players had some very good players.
That was a great team back then.
You know, the Gileses and the Bradys.
Tony Grealish, Giles. Yeah. Well, just after Giles' time. But Brady, Dave O'Leary, Frank Stapleton.
And I think in that same tour, he played against Scotland and he played against England as well. And my God, he made absolute monkeys out of England in Wembley. And they were there. They had heard about this kid, Maradona, because, of course, it was before the 1982 World Cup. And after during the 1978 World Cup, a lot of the public wanted an 18-year-old Maradona to play for Argentina because he was already regarded as the best player. And Carlos, was it Carlos Bilardo or Menotti? Minotti, yeah. Minotti, cigarette smoking Minotti, yeah. Didn't pick him for some reason.
But they reconvened. Then he was the coach at Barca over Maradona, and he adjusted the training times. He moved them from the morning to the afternoon.
Maradona could go to the nightclubs.
Both social. Yeah, and Minotti
very
was
good.
Worse.
Oh my God.
Yeah, but it made sense. He was,
and I presume you've seen Asif Kapadia's documentary, which was using home movie amazing. Footage only. Isn't it?
It's brilliant.
I urge anybody out there, if you haven't seen Maradona, the documentary by Asif Kapadia. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's super.
Yeah. And go on, Richard.
Kenny Dalglish one he's just brought out as well is
great.
Very good.
Well, listen, Richard, I'm going to plug your book here now again, and I'm going to do it in the intro when we sign off. So the book is Helenio Herrera, Master of the Dark Arts, the story of this amazing Jose Mourinho-like manager, the first superstar manager in world football, who managed the Grande Inter team, of course, in the 60s to a couple of European Cups and many league titles as well. And then he did other league titles around the world as well, and had a fascinating life story, of which it's all in this book.
Great.
An absolute pleasure talking to you, Richard. And maybe we'll hook up again some other time to talk about more general matters in football sometime.
Absolutely. I would love it. Yeah.
That'd be brilliant. Thank you so much, Richard.
And my thanks to Richard Fitzpatrick for that fascinating chat. And I'd love to get Richard on again. As you can imagine, there are lots more areas we could veer down to, and I will endeavor to get him back on again. You can get in contact with me, of course. It's mariorosenstock@gmail.com. I read them all and I get back to most of them. Anything you like, constructive criticism, suggestions for guests, sketches, new characters, or just, you know, fluff me up, tell me how great this podcast is. And if you don't, please tell one other person that you like the podcast. That's all I ask. One other person. You wouldn't believe how it takes off if one other person just tells one other person. Get in touch if you want to have a chat. Bye.